If you're writing for the enlightened public sphere, there's a premium on novelty and on intellectual coherence. That's what you get rewarded for. If you're writing for the minister, nobody cares about novelty. In fact, novelty is a bit suspect. And intellectual coherence absolutely is not a value. What matters is solving a problem, getting a job done. And you also have to change the way you pitch your ideas because you have to pitch them in a language that the minister is going to get and appreciate. Right. So when these enlightened political economists move into office, as many of them do, really a surprising number, Hume, Smith, quite a few of the physiocrats, Turgot, Vincent de Gournay, they serve in office in this period. And when they do so, they, to a degree, have to leave some of their philosophy at the door. My favorite example of this is Pierre-Samuel Dupont de Nemours, who's one of the younger physiocrats.
Welcome to Reviving Growth Keynesianism, a podcast about economic thought from the mid-20th century and why it matters to us today. Our goal is to fan the flames of a growing conversation on inequality, growth, and aggregate demand, so that we may hopefully arrive at a place of better well-being for all.
Hi, I'm your co-host, Nick Johnson, and I'm coming to you today from the University of Chicago's Center for Spatial Data Science.
My name is Chris Hong. I'm a PhD student at the University of Chicago Department of History, and I'm an intern at the Center for Spatial Data Science.
And I'm your co-host, Robert Manduca, coming to you from the Department of Sociology at the University of Michigan. Thanks for joining us.
Today, we are joined by our guest, Dr. John Shovlin. John is professor of history at NYU and the author of a brand new monograph, one that we all read for this episode. Its title is Trading with the Enemy: Britain, France, and the 18th Century Quest for a Peaceful World Order. And it's newly out with a Yale University Press. So John, welcome to the RGK podcast. And thank you again for joining us to talk about your new book.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to be here.
If I may, I wanted to get us started just by getting a sense of your scholarly and research background. So I guess, how did you get interested in researching 18th century political economy in general and the nexus of geopolitics and capitalism in particular? I know that you wrote an earlier book that came out, I believe, in 2006, titled The Political Economy of Virtue. Do you see the new book as a continuation of the themes and preoccupations in that one, or are you venturing into new territory in this latest study?
I would say it's very much going into new territory. The funny thing about the second book is that I meant to get away from political economy, and I thought that I would write a book about international history as a sort of, you know, try something completely different. And I found that political economy ended up being central to the story I wanted to tell. So I didn't get away from it for very long. I'd like to be able to say that the book Trading with the Enemy, that it sprang from some fundamental insight that came early on about the relationship between capitalism, geopolitics, and political economy, but it really didn't. Where it came from was that I stumbled onto this interesting pattern of events, a series of moments in Franco-British relations where one or both sides were trying to cut a deal that would transform the relationship and make it more peaceful and the international order more stable. And, you know, this is very much not something that's talked about much in the historiography. So I thought, well, this is really interesting and cool. And the original question was simply, you know, what's going on here? How do we explain this? And, you know, what light does it shed more broadly on international history in this period? But over time, I started to realize that I couldn't actually answer that question without thinking about a bigger question, which was, what were the consequences of an emergent capitalism for international order in the 18th century? The question shifted, and I suppose the big insight that eventually emerged is that capitalism was a source of tremendous conflict in the 18th century, but it also impelled a series of efforts to try to transform the international order, to push it in a more peaceful and stable direction. And I think that there are implications in that, not just for capitalism in the 18th century, but capitalism in subsequent periods also.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I guess we'll be getting into the future-oriented aspect of that a little bit later on the show. But yeah, you mentioned the sort of historiography of the 18th century and sort of Anglo-French rivalry against the background of what historians have called, you know, the Second Hundred Years' War. And maybe for our listeners who who aren't early modernists. I was wondering if you could give a sense of how the 18th century international system functioned and maybe how it differs from, you know, the world that we're familiar with today and its kind of modes of international governance, multilateral institutions, et cetera. But yeah, what was the international system like, and how would you set England and France against the background of the workings of the system?
I think it's almost a kind of classic realist arrangement where you have six or seven great powers moving in and out of alliance with one another, competing for influence, in some cases for territorial aggrandizement in these sort of fracture zones in Europe, in Central Europe, in Italy, in the Balkans, places where there are smaller states, weaker states. The second dimension of it is that many of these great powers have overseas empires and are deeply invested in the expansion of their global trade, so that the struggle for trade and empire becomes a second dimension among most of these great powers. And it's really that it's that second dimension that is more central for my book, because what interests me here is the struggle between France and Britain between 1688, the Glorious Revolution, and 1815, the Battle of Waterloo. In that long 18th century, France and Britain are at war with one another, basically 1 year in two, eight major wars in this period that involve these two powers as sort of major players. So this is, you know, rightly seen as a period of relatively unabating conflict between these two states. And because they are financial heavyweights in Europe, and because they're capable of assembling coalitions of other states behind them when they go to war, a lot of these wars become general wars. And of course, they have all kinds of global extensions because of the global trading and imperial concerns of both states. So that's the general background. What interests me in the book, and you know, the reason why I think there's a new story to be told here, is that there are this whole series of efforts between the 1710s and the 1780s to change that pattern of competition between France and Britain. I mean, maybe one way to translate it for the 21st century listener would be to say that they're interested in transforming a geopolitical pattern of conflict into a geoeconomic pattern of conflict. The idea is never that they're going to be friends. The point is the two countries are going to continue to be rivals, enemies, but that they're going to fight out that conflict on the terrain of commerce rather than on the battlefield. And the people who are interested in making these deals see significant benefits to their own side in trying to change the pattern of international competition in that way.
That's really good background. Thank you. Maybe as a way in, because you really start the book with the conclusion of the War of the Spanish Succession and the sort of general peace of Utrecht, right, which is around 1713, 1714. And the pivot of that story really seems to be, the geographical pivot, I should say, really seems to be around Spanish America, the Spanish American Empire, and particularly access to resources in the South Seas. So I guess I was reading this maybe proleptically, and I was thinking about, I guess I had in mind, you know, oil-rich regions today where there's this kind of cluster of key resources, right, then kind of suck in these great powers. Mm. So I was wondering if you could maybe flesh out this image, you know, what was achieved by the Peace of Utrecht, and why was Spanish America such a fraught sort of hotspot that was contested between Britain and France in this period?
Okay. I mean, that's a really interesting analogy with oil-rich regions of today. You know, if there's a commodity at the center of this story of Spanish America's strategic importance, it's silver. Spanish America is the source of as much as 90% of the world's supply of silver in the 18th century. And silver is a commodity like no other. It is the basis of the money supply in Europe, and not just in Europe, of course, but in many other parts of the world, including in China. And it's also the basis for Europe-Asia trade in this period, because it's the commodity that Europeans principally ship to Asia in return for manufactures from Bengal or the Coromandel Coast or Chinese silks and porcelains. So it is both the what makes the world turn in terms of trade and the basis of the currency in Europe. So it's a commodity of just vast strategic significance. All the major European trading states are interested in grabbing as large a share of Spanish American markets as they can. So the idea is you export your manufacturers to Spanish America and you bring home silver in return. This trade is officially a monopoly of the city of Cadiz in Spain. It's organized as a sort of government-controlled monopoly in Spain. But in fact, in the decades before the war, which begins in 1701, this trade has become a kind of informal condominium of French, British, and Dutch traders. And that's a relatively stable situation, that the three big trading powers are each getting a piece of the pie. The problem arises in 1700 when the Spanish king dies and a French prince, grandson of Louis XIV, becomes the king of Spain. And then what that threatens is the prospect that the Dutch and the English are going to be pushed out of the Spanish-American trade and that it's going to become some kind of quasi-French monopoly. And that's going to have enormous implications over time for the balance of power. The balance of commercial power in the first place, but the way they think about it, the balance of power rests on a balance of commercial power. So Spanish America is the pivot, as you put it well, of the War of Spanish Succession for that reason. The term the South Seas refers to the Pacific coast of Spanish America. The reason it's so important is because if you're a European trader and you're trying to do an end run around the official Spanish trade, one way to do it is to sail around Cape Horn into the Pacific and trade directly with Peru or the settlements in Chile. So the South Sea just refers to that trade, and it's a kind of it's imagined as a kind of El Dorado in this period. So I don't want to run on too long about this. That's the underlying struggle here.
You mentioned just now the balance of commercial power and the need that the different powers sought to preserve that. This was one of the things that I sort of was really fascinated in the book, this idea of commercial power. And I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about, you know, what they meant by that or how they saw that, and then how it related to the geopolitical power or what we might think of as more traditional forms of like military power.
They refer confusingly to the balance of commerce, by which they mean two completely different things. One is what we mean by the balance of commerce, but depending on context, they mean a different thing by it, which is a balance of wealth or the potential to produce wealth, but specifically wealth produced in foreign trade. Foreign trade is a special and privileged sector from the perspective of European states in this period, because it's seen to feed directly into state capacity. What foreign trade does is it potentially expands the money supply. It produces all kinds of taxable transactions, increasing the revenues of states. If you can have a positive trade balance, you can produce pools of money abroad that can be tapped to pay subsidies to allies or to pay for armies abroad. Most importantly, foreign trade creates the pools of capital which states can borrow in wartime. All of these wars in the 18th century are debt financed. If you look at the British debt by the end of the Napoleonic Wars, it's actually higher than at any other period in British history except the end of World War II. So this is a period really of extraordinary public borrowing. And all of these officials are convinced correctly that you just can't do that without the constant inputs of foreign trade. So that's why commerce, well, they just call it commerce, but more precisely, that's why foreign trade is seen as so strategically central, and why they start to think of the balance of power as being measured in terms of a balance of commerce, or a balance in the potential to generate commercial wealth now and in the future, that being the foundation for military capacity.
As I'm listening to you talk, I'm reminded a lot of the theories of John Mearsheimer at UChicago. The idea, offensive realism, you need to sort of take your gains where you can. Power rests on wealth and therefore commerce. And I was also reminded of this as I was reading the book, because you sort of read political economy not as a kind of canonical set of thinkers that are in a timeless conversation with one another about sort of the nature of our collective life. But, you know, it's very specific officials looking at very specific ways that they can advance their state interests at very specific times. Can you say more about this move to sort of decanonize the concept of political economy and how that relates to the way that you're analyzing the international state system?
So I take political economy to be in the 18th century, principally an advice language for the managers of commercial states engaged in competition with other commercial states. I think that this is a vision of political economy that's central to Ishvan Hunt's work as well. And Hunt is a really important influence on my book. And I can say more about that, about the similarities and the differences later on. Interestingly, though, Hunt himself wasn't actually interested in any of these managers of commercial states. If you look at his work, he's only looking at men of letters, right? He's looking at intellectuals, writers, people who are producing published work. So there is a sort of significant bias, let's call it, in the intellectual history of political economy in the 18th century towards published work, and especially towards the most sophisticated exponents of a kind of philosophical political economy, the David Humes, Adam Smiths, and physiocrats of the world. I don't mean to deny the importance of those canonical authors, but I think there's a really interesting question to be asked about what the relationship was between those works and the political economy that is part of the policy conversation at all times, and that's always central, for example, to the management of empires and to the management of foreign policy. So I'm very interested in officials as readers of that canonical political economy. I think where Hunt tends to sort of just, there just isn't a reception problem for him. I think the reception problem is really important. How were these canonical authors read? And I think it's clear that they were read extremely selectively. Officials read the better known published political economists, read them closely, read them intelligently, and then borrowed from them selectively, highly selectively. So, you take an idea of Smith's about competitiveness and you use it to solve some particular problem you're having at the moment, and you leave behind the ethical structure, the politics, the epistemology, all the stuff we think is important gets left behind in this transaction. So we have this idea that intellectuals influence politicians. I think that's a problematic idea. It makes it feel like the agency lies with the ideas, but it doesn't. The agency lies with the politicians, with the officials. They're the ones who are kind of picking and choosing, often from opposing sides of political debates or political economic debates, and then putting these ideas together in new ways, and usually embedding them in older ways of thinking about political economy that, we call it mercantilism, call it neo-Machiavellian political economy, call it what you will. But the structure of official political economic thinking isn't coming from Smith or Hume or the physiocrats. The structure is something older and deeper than that, and tied to the kinds of problems that officials wrestle with in the daily management of these commercial states in struggles with other commercial states. I actually think that if we're going to talk about influence, there's a more interesting or deeper story to be told about influence running in the other direction. It's the agendas of the officials and the politicians that are profoundly influencing Enlightenment political economy, setting the agenda of problems that are really worth wrestling with, that have to be resolved, that have to be dealt with. I'm also, though, interested in thinking about officials, not just as consumers of political economy, but as producers. I think we have to recognize that they're not just rating the Enlightenment for ideas about political economy. They're very creative and innovative in the way they're putting together political economic ideas themselves. And that's something which you often have to look in manuscripts to see, because these are conversations that are happening in ministries or among ministries, and they're often not making it into the public sphere, often for very good reason, because there are state secrets or strategic considerations that are in play. So that's my kind of broad take, I suppose, on decanonizing political economy in this period.
I was also wondering, because it's structural, right? Because sometimes people who produce political economy for the public, for an enlightened public, then become officials like Jacques Turgot, right? And they too leave behind their kind of like grand epistemological ambitions for the practical work of policymaking. So there's something about actually being in the cockpit that sort of clarifies the stakes or reduces them
or changes them, right? I mean, if you're writing for the enlightened public sphere, there's a premium on novelty and on intellectual coherence. That's what you get rewarded for. If you're writing for the minister, nobody cares about novelty. In fact, novelty is a bit suspect. And intellectual coherence absolutely is not a value. What matters is solving a problem, getting a job done. And you also have to change the way you pitch your ideas, because you have to pitch them in a language that the minister is going to get and appreciate, right? So when these enlightened political economists move into office, as many of them do, really a surprising number, Hume, Smith, quite a few of the physiocrats, Turgot, Vincent de Gournay, they serve in office in this period. And when they do so, they, to a degree, have to leave some of their philosophy at the door. My favorite example of this is Pierre-Samuel Dupont de Nemours, who's one of the younger physiocrats, but he's seen as kind of one of the purer physiocrats. So he ends up in office. He actually ends up as a kind of aide to Vergennes, who's the French foreign minister in the 1780s, very powerful figure. Vergennes is interested in making a free trade treaty with Britain. And this resonates with the physiocracy of Dupont de Nemours in certain important ways. The physiocrats have been pushing for free trade with Britain for ages. And so Dupont is quite involved in pushing this treaty within the administration. He writes dozens of memoranda explaining why this would be a good thing for France. Interestingly, instead of pushing the idea, which is the central claim of physiocracy, that France needs to return to its agricultural roots in order to thrive as a modern kingdom, Dupont embraces the agenda of the Minister of Finance, Calonn, which says the purpose of the treaty is to make French manufacturers more competitive. So we're going to somewhat lower the barriers to British products coming into France. That's going to light a fire under French manufacturers, but we're not going to expose them to so much competition that they're going to get put out of business, just enough to make them competitive. Dupont absolutely gets on board that train. He makes the argument, often using physiocratic language, but it's not basically a physiocratic argument. He leaves the structure of physiocracy behind and borrows certain elements from physiocratic language in order to make the case both within the administration and later on outside of it. So this is a common pattern. There is a kind of revolving door between the public sphere and the official world in this period. But again, it's the imperatives of the official world that tend to win out here, that tend to structure the conversation and that get embodied in policy.
Yeah, kind of going off of that, I'm wondering, because this might be retreading a little bit too, but there's often this sort of potted history, I guess, especially in the intellectual history of kind of French political economy, where, you know, beginning with perhaps Jean-Baptiste Colbert in the last third of this 17th century, and then moving from this sort of arch mercantilist position of Colbert's to the beginnings of liberal political economy and free trade, perhaps, like Nick mentioned, I think Turgot is probably the main figure there in the 18th century. But I think the way you describe it, a lot of these officials you describe as sort of heirs to Colbert, or at least Colbert's kind of strategic thinking around the uses and abuses of both protectionism and of free trade. So I was wondering if you could, and you bring up these kind of ideas, proposals, trade liberalization between France and Britain. I was wondering if you could go into how exactly free trade was conceived, both by, well, I guess mainly by these officials that take center place in your book, and how it kind of, I guess, pulls us away from this caricature of what free trade was, or at least the beginnings of free trade in the 18th century.
We think of free trade as a liberal idea. I mean, even the language that we use to describe this, the liberalization of trade, right? We just take it as read that free trade is a liberal agenda. One of the main points of the book, and it isn't just my work that suggests this. There's been, you know, quite a bit of work in the last 5-10 years that's pushing the same direction. What I'm showing, to put it in the baldest way possible, is that there is a deep mercantilist tradition of free trade, and that's the dominant tradition of free trade thinking in the 18th century, and that it goes back much earlier than the High Enlightenment of the 1760s or 1770s. I mean, they're talking about free trade intensively already in the 1690s, and it's absolutely central at the end of major wars, end of War of Spanish Succession, for example, as you already mentioned, Chris. So how are they thinking about free trade? What does it mean to talk about free trade as a mercantilist project? Well, I think two ideas are really central. One is the idea that free trade can function as a device to create a kind of balance of wealth, a balance of commercial power. So to come back to the end of the War of Spanish Succession, there's all kinds of deal making going on about how Britain, France, and the Dutch can gain equal access to the trade of Spanish America as a way to prevent any one of them from becoming a monopolist and thereby threatening the balance of commercial power. So that's one of the fundamental ways that people who think in a mercantilist way think about free trade. It is simply a device that is going to help to preserve a balance of advantage among great trading states vis-a-vis key commercial resources in other parts of the world. The second way they think about it is as a complement to protection. So they're all completely committed to the idea that you have to protect strategic sectors. So we've talked a lot about empires and foreign trade and so forth. But another strategic sector that they talk about endlessly is manufacturing. Manufacturing, it's not really valuable unless you are competitive enough to compete for world markets. But where you need to go as a state is to get to the point where you're producing goods that are manufactured goods that are competitive on world markets. This means mostly textiles in this period. You need protection for that. Everybody knows this. However, protection comes with all kinds of unintended consequences, downsides. For example, protection comes with reduced trade flows between nations. Reduced trade flows means reduced taxation. A little bit of free trade in the mix, especially in sectors that aren't going to hurt you too badly. So let that British hardware in, because we don't really have a hardware industry, or ours is, you know, it's not going to survive in the long run anyway. But we'll continue to protect our woolen industry, but we're going to let British hardware in, right? So it's always a selective view of free trade. There's never any question of some kind of blanket free trade. You're going to pick and choose the sectors where it's going to be advantageous to you, or at least where it's not going to do you too much damage. And one of the payoffs is there's going to be new taxation on trade, and that's going to be good for the exchequer. Another example is, we already touched on this, the French ministry in the 1780s is very worried about the first stirrings of industrialization in Britain, worried about the need to bring French manufacturers up to speed, get them using machinery. How do you do that? Well, you open a chink in the protective walls, you let some British product in at a price that's going to incentivize the French to compete, but not put them out of business. So free trade is not the opposite of protection. It's its complement. And this way of thinking about free trade goes back to Colbert. And Colbert is thinking in these terms. The first beneficiaries of this are the Dutch, you know, in the treaties of Nijmegen and again in the Treaty of Rijswijk. So this is an old idea. It's deeply embedded in these mercantilist traditions. And it emerges in the 18th century, as a particularly important tool to try to address the fundamental dysfunction in the international order, which is that it produces way too much conflict. Free trade can be a means to reduce that conflict, either by distributing the advantage of trade more broadly. Another nice example of this is French involvement in the American War. I mean, why do the French support the American revolutionaries? Well, they do so because they think that the American market has become the key to Britain's future prosperity, that that market is going to continue to grow very, very quickly, and that it's going to fundamentally unbalance this balance of commercial power that they're all worried about. So you need to pull Britain out of the British Empire. You need to turn it into a free trader. You need to open it to all of Europe so that the benefits get distributed broadly. Now, of course, that was a wager that played out very badly for France, because the British managed to hold on to their markets in America. That was the thinking, that free trade could serve as a way to produce balance, and balance could be the foundation of stability and peace, because if there's balance, then your existential security is not threatened by the other state. Free trade crops up again and again at the end of wars also, because these mercantilist officials assume that one further advantage of it, in addition to the ones we've already talked about, is that if the British have an interest, have a material interest in exporting to France and vice versa, that will tend to cool the political temperature. They'll be less likely to start a war over, you know, something gratuitous if they're going to lose significant markets in France as a consequence. So that's a piece of the puzzle that actually starts to sound like liberal ideas, but the thinking isn't really liberal. It just sort of looks like it.
Yeah, the last piece you said, that's sort of the thought of one of my favorite figures from this period, Henry St. John, Viscount Bolingbroke, right? At the Peace of Utrecht, he was sort of thinking that since the Glorious Revolution, the sort of protective walls erected around Britain and France vis-a-vis trade, they were actually kind of spurring French manufacturing. They were kind of housing French manufacturing sort of in response to, you know, perceived British ascendancy, I guess, especially in woolens. I think that's the sector that he was thinking about. But he, against the Whigs, right, that he wanted to perhaps normalize trade relations with France so that British woolens could essentially penetrate French markets and sort of counteract this period of like competitive kind of house industrialization that he sort of sees happening, right? It would be really fascinating.
It's a kind of very early free trade imperialism. You see the same arguments in France. The French say, so the British have built industries in silk and paper making, French specialties, with the coming of Huguenot refugees and then with high protective barriers around those industries between the Glorious Revolution and the end of the War of Spanish Succession. And the French say that we will wipe out these counterfeits, that's what they call them, counterfeits, if we can just get access to the British market at any kind of reasonable terms. We're going to wipe out these guys very quickly. So both sides see that advantage. And both sides are also hoping to preserve what they see as their most vital sectors. The woolen is the key one for Bolingbroke. But notice here that this is a shifting of the terrain of struggle from slogging it out on the battlefields of Flanders, which from Bolingbroke's perspective was just a disaster, to slogging it out for markets and for market share and for strategic industries, right? It's not that Bolingbroke actually wants an alliance with France, but it's not that he imagines Britain and France can be anything other than rivals, but that rivalry could be prosecuted in a much more rational way, a way that was much more beneficial to Britain in the long run than the kind of geopolitical struggle of the War of Spanish Succession, which ran up this enormous public debt, which Bolingbroke was absolutely paranoid about in terms of it, both its constitutional consequences and its economic ones.
Yeah, the story of debt and state credit plays a really big role in the story that you tell, which I drew my attention in particular because this is a Keynesian podcast and we're interested in Keynes and kind of people that he was looking at and reading and interested in, and the figure of John Law sort of naturally comes up because John Law is a guy who wants to, if I read correctly, basically solve world peace through state provision of credit, right? Mm-hmm. And then this John Law kind of like he's a really insane figure, honestly, right? Like he's a an alleged murderer in Scotland who somehow talks his way into the court at Versailles. So I'm really curious how that happened, but his scheme ultimately fails. And then that casts a really long shadow on, I guess, state banks in France for the next couple centuries. So can you just tell us a little bit about like John Law and what his system was?
Sure. He's not an alleged murderer. He is actually a murderer, but he kills the man in a duel. So it's in the morality, the gentlemanly morality of the time, it's excusable. He is jailed, but they sort of let him escape. The right people are paid off, and he escapes at first to Scotland, where there isn't extradition to Britain at that point, or to England at that point. Then after the Act of Union in 1707, he has to move to the continent. Yes, you could see him as crazy. I think it'd be more appropriate to see him as a genius, maybe with a kind of a con man edge to him. He is probably the most creative and original theorist of money in the early 18th century. Certainly everyone at the time thinks of him in those terms, and his legacy as a theorist of money has survived into the 20th and 21st century. In 1716, he manages to convince the regent, who's, he's running the French kingdom in this period. Louis XV is just a small boy, convinces the regent to let him open a bank, issuing paper money. And within 3 years, he has established a couple of huge companies that effectively have a monopoly on France's trade outside of Europe. He uses the largest of these companies, the Company of the Indies, in 1719-20. To organize a debt consolidation scheme, where the idea is that he's going to basically roll over the entire French public debt into the company as shares in the company. Now, this is modeled on the South Sea Company, which was founded in 1711, but he's just doing what the South Sea Company did on a far more grandiose scale. So it doesn't seem crazy from the perspective of the period. It seems doable, but huge. So what's the relationship here to geopolitics or to world peace? This is the part of law's story that I find really interesting and where I've done some research. Law says that he calls it his system. He says if his system had survived, it would have assured the peace of Europe. And this is not something he just says in an off the cuff way once or twice. It's there, you know, it's there through many, many, many of his statements. What he means by that, well, he means two things. He means first that if France moves to a system where they're using paper money instead of silver as the basis of the money supply, then right there, they're no longer competing with the Dutch or the British for a dominant share of Spanish-American trade. So that which had been so thorny an issue, so central to the War of Spanish Succession, the war that has just concluded, it suddenly disappears as a fundamental bone of contention between European states, at least between France and other European states. The other piece of it is that he says with an adequate money supply that's not constrained in this deflationary way by the amount of silver you have in circulation, you're going to push down interest rates, greatly increase employment, foster a broad-based prosperity in France. And France, taking advantage over time of its huge population, it's got three times the population of Britain in this period, is going to become a kind of commercial superstate. But instead of using that tremendous commercial power to, you know, crush its rivals and enemies, it's going to be a kind of benevolent hegemon. It's going to be too powerful to feel threatened by any combination of other states, and it will have no interest in conquering its rivals because, and this is also central to Law's discourse, war is fundamentally damaging to commerce. And this is an argument that's very easy to make in 1715, 1716, because the French economy is absolutely ruined by the two great wars of the end of Louis XIV's reign. So, you know, the argument that war is utterly destructive of trade, but that trade is the true foundation of power, that looks very convincing in 1715, 1716, and that is central to Law's discourse. So you can see with that set of ideas in play that the argument that his system, his revolution, is going to create a peaceful Europe is plausible. Those are the arguments he makes, and I think this is one of the reasons why his schemes seem attractive.
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean that he was crazy, but just that his life story is yes. Kind of unbelievable, right?
It is unbelievable. It's like something out of a bad movie.
So why did this scheme fail then, if it was so brilliant? Because you know, it sounds convincing on paper, right?
Yeah.
Braudel suggests kind of offhandedly that it was because the French economy was insufficiently mature, that it didn't have the proper sort of like relations of production at home to take advantage of all the expanded paper money that maybe Britain had at that point. But if I read your book correctly, there's a massive geopolitical sort of entanglement in his scheme that like it gets sort of intercepted by British attacks on it as well, that are involved in its undoing. Is that right?
Right. So I think, you know, why the scheme failed, there's not one reason. There's a sort of series of errors and problems. I think it's very clear that if Law had stuck with his 1716 bank and modestly increased the proportions of the note issue over time, that the thing would have been just a swimming success. It's really the size and the grandiosity of it, and especially the way it gets entangled with the problem of consolidating the public debt that destroys it. But the interesting story here, from my point of view, and Nick, what you just brought up is the way that Law perceives that his system is being attacked from Britain. Attacked by the creation of a competing debt consolidation scheme by Britain's South Sea Company.
Can you just maybe spell out real quick how debt consolidation works?
The idea is that you try to lower the interest rate on the public debt by, so the French bondholders are supposed to swap their bonds for stock in Law's company. They get a guaranteed 3% return that's guaranteed by the state. So the state continues to pay interest to the company and the company is going to disperse it in the form of dividends. But in addition, they have the prospect of making additional dividends from the commercial profits of the company and capital appreciation on their shares, right? So in theory, it's a good deal for the shareholders. And there's plenty of propaganda to kind of whip up enthusiasm for this idea. In Britain, the South Sea Company proposes to do something kind of similar. There isn't really a strong claim about the enormous profits the South Sea Company is going to make, although there's some of that. The main idea is simply that you're going to consolidate the debt at a lower rate of interest. And this is a further, this is, it's advantageous to do this in the form of company shares rather than simply in the form of, you know, newly issued government debt, because company shares are much more, they're minimal formalities to transfer ownership. And law and people like law in Britain argue that company shares function as a kind of adjunct to the money supply. They create a kind of liquidity, and everyone is, you know, thinks there's not enough liquidity rightly in these monetary systems. Okay, so the South Sea Company in end of 1719, going to 1720, proposes to do this debt consolidation scheme in Britain. Law sees this as a direct attack on his system because he is depending on capital flowing from London and other European financial centers into Paris to help buoy the price of shares and maintain the idea that these shares are going to grow in value and thereby persuade French bondholders to swap their bonds for shares. So what happens is, as soon as the South Sea scheme gets started, you see the capital flows reverse. And you can even see it it's so sudden at one point that you can actually see it in a sudden change in the value of the pound versus the livre tournois, which is the French currency. So this is a real concern. And Law takes it, Law assumes that this is orchestrated by his enemies as a way to bring down his system. That's probably not true, but it's not implausible in the context. He takes all kinds of steps to try to reel in the South Sea Company, to prevent the South Sea scheme. So France and Britain have been cooperating closely, and he's been involved in that cooperation. He pulls his cooperation. He tries to get his main French partner disgraced. He basically puts it up to the British: if you don't rein in the South Sea Company scheme, I'm going to torpedo good relations between France and Britain. That doesn't work. So the next thing he tries is spreading rumors that he's bought huge volumes of South Sea stock and he's going to dump it all on the market in one go and create a kind of financial panic and stampede other foreign investors out of France. He doesn't do that either. He then threatens to subsidize a Russian Jacobite invasion of Britain as another way to spook the markets. Needless to say, he doesn't do any of these things because, of course, he sees in the end that if he brings London capital markets crashing down, there's going to be immediate ripples in Paris and his own system is going to collapse. So there's a really kind of interesting story here about international finance becoming a field of struggle between states in these competing debt consolidation schemes. But in the end, none of this amounts to very much. And both systems collapse in 1720, not really because they're being attacked by the other side, but because they were unsoundly constructed. And in the case of the South Sea Company, fraudulently constructed, perhaps in the case of Law system also.
Yeah, it's such a great bit in the book. It's almost tragic the way Law's project kind of like dialectically unfolds, right? It begins as sort of a project for perpetual peace. It's aimed at solving perhaps jealousy of trade, at least in terms of Spanish silver. But then because of the destabilizing effects of kind of international finance in this period, capital flows, it becomes what you call like battle over credit or the jealousy of credit, right? It's very dialectical how that develops. I had proceeding chronologically as we move past maybe the Regency period in France into what you describe as a sort of almost period of détente, right? This is kind of the 30s and the 40s with the two prime ministers, both in Britain and France. We have on the one hand, Sir Robert Walpole, kind of our Whig oligarchy. And on the other side, we have Cardinal Fleury, right? In France, who sort of, they're kind of, they both want the same thing, which is reduced military spending, right? Smaller navies and smaller sums spent on the army and more trade between France and Britain. But what I found really interesting, because in the chapter title, you evoke this concept of uneven development, which it takes me back into, you know, the classical, almost Marxist concept of uneven combined development. And as you show in the chapter, détente gradually collapses because of the various sort of perceived leads and lags in terms of development between Britain and France. So I was wondering if you could flesh out this concept of uneven development in it and how it applies in this period, in this kind of period of limbo before really, I guess, a new series of wars beginning in the 40s.
This period when Walpole and Fleury are in power is really the longest period of Franco-British conciliation in this whole, you know, long 18th century. And it's, you know, it's interesting to me for that reason. And it seems clear that the principal reason or one of the principal reasons for this period of relative harmony is that both sides are convinced that peace best serves their own commercial growth. I mean, Walpole just says this endlessly. He says, Britain is a commercial state, Britain is a trading state, and trading states benefit most from peace. Flocky and the officials around him think exactly the same thing. One of the main rationales among people in both countries who are interested in changing the nature of the relationship is that their side is going to benefit most from peace, right? That if you want to either aggrandize yourself or preserve the balance of power, whatever it is you're going for, you're more likely to achieve that peacefully than through war. The problem is that it appears to Walpole's opponents in Parliament, the so-called Patriot Whigs, France is gaining much more and much faster from this policy of peace than Britain is. Britain's trade is growing sluggishly in the 1720s and 30s. France is growing really, really fast. Its colonial development is really taking off. This is the moment where Saint-Domingue is what becomes its most valuable colony. In fact, the most valuable colony in the world. This is the period it's taking off first in the 20s and 30s. So these Patriot Whigs are saying, you know, this policy of peace is producing a situation where France is threatening to become the dominant commercial power. It is, in fact, threatening our security for that reason. So one of the truly perverse things about this as a system of international relations is that states, in a perfectly peaceful way pursuing their development, become a threat to the security of other states. And that's really what I'm trying to get at in this idea of uneven development. And ultimately, the way this plays out, the Patriots manage to turn a kind of minor crisis in Anglo-Spanish relations at the end of the 1730s into a war, which they use to oust Walpole and to, you know, get the war they wanted, which they use not directly to attack France, but to break into the markets of Spanish America. The idea is to seize enclaves in Spanish America that you can use to establish what they call a free trade with Spanish America, a free trade from which will allow them to balance more successfully against France, which they assume all along is penetrating Spanish markets more successfully than they are. They're probably not right about that. But the point is that in this context, preemptive war starts to look like a good idea. And ultimately, Walpole's rivals are able to make that argument compellingly.
This chapter was, I think, one of the more distressing ones for me to read. I think important, but like, you know, we've been talking about how there's been this conflict and then they finally get to a system where they're like, oh, it's in all of our mutual interests to, you know, to actually do this thing. We're going to have the competition be economic instead of military because that'll be better for everyone and we will have peace. And they manage it for whatever, a couple of decades. And then it becomes the case that, like, you know, if you have a peaceful system, then if one state might start to benefit from that, you know, in this case, France seemed to be either catching up or doing well. And then that in itself, that development is arguably the goal of the peace, or like, we want to have the competition be economic, not military. Like, that in itself is a reason enough to start a military conflict again. I know it's so sad, I guess, but and it sort of reminded me of, you know, where you were just discussing the law scheme, where he was like, you know, we'll have European peace and then France will become the hegemon. And it's like, well, maybe this is sort of what seem to be happening, and then, you know, that in itself is enough to undo the whole project.
Yeah, so I mean, you have this ironic situation where everyone assumes that the worst thing that could possibly happen is for the other side to become hegemonic. But when one side becomes hegemonic, as Britain does after 1815, at least for a bit, it's actually conducive to stability. Far from being disastrous for French influence, security, and prosperity, it's actually quite good for France. Does very nicely in the 19th century. You know, there are a couple of interesting things here. There's the problem of uneven development, the problem of this kind of fundamental weakness or perversity of a geopolitical order that is founded or based on capitalism, which is that peaceful economic development ultimately creates or is perceived to create a security dilemma. I mean, we're going to see this again in the 19th century, where you have the rise. I think we used to think about this as the rise of Germany, but I think now we're thinking about it even more as the rise of the United States as the fundamental destabilizing factor in late 19th, early 20th century geopolitics. This is the thing people are really worried about, a new kind of state is enormous and that has its supply chains mostly on its own territory, that seems invulnerable and is also profoundly protectionist. And it just seems like it's going to eat everyone else's lunch. And this is this pushes, you know, German policymakers towards Weltpolitik, pushes Japanese policymakers in a similar direction. And of course, here we are again in the early 21st century, where the peaceful growth of a great trading state at a certain point, a certain tipping point, starts to look like a profound threat to the security and prosperity of states which had been content to trade with it for several decades. So there is an interesting way in which there are regularities, let's say, in a capitalist system of geopolitics, which I would argue have been there since, you know, at least since the late 17th century.
Moving back to this period of perhaps détente in the early half of the 18th century, what I found really, really original and interesting in your interpretation is that the constituency that really topples the peace in Britain is this sort of like merchant planter slash kind of patriot radical Whig sort of grouping, right? And I guess in the historiography, these guys are often portrayed as almost apostles of modernity, right? Even though they're, you know, their ideas are, they get their ideas from so-called classical republicanism, but they point towards, I guess, you know, the American Revolution, right? Patriot ideology and perhaps the age of revolutions more broadly. But in your book, these guys are the hardcore Cold War hawks. they're almost like McCarthyites avant la lettre, right? And I was curious, like, do their recommendations and does their dissent make sense? Or is it just purely, you know, are they just pure ideologues, I guess? And do you see any connection between their anti-French kind of pro-war sentiments in this period and perhaps, you know, the full flowering of that with, you know, someone like Pitt the Elder's war ministry during the Seven Years' War and even, you know, patriots in British America?
I mean, I do. I mean, Pitt the Elder is one of these people, right? He's one of the people who's really beating the drum for war in the 1730s. I mean, on the one hand, you can see the rationality of the argument they're making, because French trade and French plantation agriculture are growing very, very quickly in this period, much, much faster than Britain's are. So France, in part because it's commercially underdeveloped in the way that underdeveloped states do, develops quickly. And that catch-up process can look frightening to dominant commercial states. It is interesting, though, if you look at these patriots and if you follow them out into the early 1760s, Pitt's an exception, but most of them have come to the conclusion that the war with Spain in 1739 and almost everything that followed from it was a mistake, that they would have been much better off following the Walpolean policy of preserving the peace with France and aggrandizing Britain through peaceful trade. Almost all of them had come to that conclusion. So much so that a couple in Pitt's cabinet in 1761 basically forced Pitt out because he held to his dying breath to the proposition that the purpose of these mid-century wars was to smash France as a commercial and naval state, and that would be the basis of his Empire of Liberty. That is a kind of British-dominated free trade zone that would extend to the Americas. And that, you know, even the French might, if they could make their peace with it, benefit from. The end of the Seven Years' War, which this is 1756 to 63, but it's really winding down in 1761 as Pitt's being pushed out and as these former patriots like the Duke of Bedford or the Earl of Bute are now making arguments, hard arguments for peace. And this moment is important because it dramatizes the other key impulsion towards peace and stability in this period that's coming out of this kind of capitalist geopolitical order. And that is the problem of public debt, the problem of financial blowbacks from war. These wars are being fought to secure or advantage trade. And the worry is that they're producing financial consequences that are going to strangle commerce. They're giving rise to these enormous public debts. They're pushing up interest rates. There's always a huge burden of additional taxation in the wake of all of these wars. Much of that taxation falls on trade, right, in the form of customs duties. So it is, you're slowly killing the goose that lays the golden egg through the financial unintended consequences of fighting these very long wars against a financially capable opponent. The only way out of this, the only way out of the problem of public debt and the threat it represents to your long-term prosperity is to stop fighting major wars against the only other state that is financially capable of fighting a 7 years war. Over and again, this is the factor that impels officials on both sides to find a better way to do this, to of course, to prosecute the rivalry, but to do it in a way that is less threatening to the long-run prosperity and promises a more successful fruition to this long rivalry.
So from that perspective, I guess, which is kind of a Humean perspective, that like public debt represents a grave threat to civilization, because that it just means that like all your wealth is tied up in the sovereign and the sovereign can default anytime he wants. These schemes for paper credit are, I mean, reactionary from that perspective, right? Like they only make it easier for states to go into debt and therefore to, you know, go to war.
Yeah. So there's two sides to public debt, I think, in the 18th century. The more familiar side is that the financial revolution in Britain in the 1690s, which modernizes Britain's public credit system and turns it into a state capable of borrowing huge sums of money over the 18th and early 19th century, that this is a fundamental sort of source, really not a direct source of conflict, but a facilitator of conflict. I mean, if you couldn't have borrowed all this money, you could never have fought all these wars. I mean, Britain in the 17th century is a sort of second rank European state, becomes a first rank European state after the financial revolution. So I think that's the dominant story about public credit in this period, that it's a fundamental part of the fiscal military state and it makes broader conflict possible. And this is one of Hume's objections. The other side to it, and this you see represented in law, but not just in law, but in people among people like, say, William Paterson, who's one of the founders of the Bank of England. They think that public credit represents another possibility, the possibility of using a credit currency to replace dependence on hard money, which in turn liberates you, as we've already discussed, from the need to struggle geopolitically for dominance in world markets or for control over strategic resources like Spanish American silver. So there's a possibility that's embedded in modern public credit that points towards peaceful development and a retreat from the relentlessly extroverted political economy of early modern great powers that will allow for a happier future for everybody. And you can see that as early as the middle of the 17th century among the so-called Hartlib Circle, who are a group of British political economists around the Prussian thinker Samuel Hartlib. This is something that Carl Wendland has written a very interesting book about. But you can see that these dreams of a more peaceful and prosperous future are there really from the first stirrings, the first intellectual stirrings of the financial revolution.
So it would be a shift from a problematic centered around international circulation and trade and specie towards one of internal growth and development.
That's right.
I think this is, Nick, you're familiar with Mike Stoninger's work, but he calls this like the Janus face of public credit or something like that, right? And I feel like from a Keynesian perspective, it's highly relevant, you know, today, because you either have military Keynesianism, right, or you have kind of a more pacific, or hopefully more pacific, form of social democracy fueled by deficit spending or something like that, right? Yeah, I guess it's an enduring Keynesian sort of dilemma we have on our hands here.
Well, what's difficult about that, though, is that internal development tends to come along with a lot of class conflict, right? Because you have all these questions about, like, well, you know, what's the role of the aristocracy in commerce or, you know, growth and development? Now, should they farm? Should they not? Whereas, you know, you can get a unified block around war with England because that's taking somebody else's stuff rather than rearranging your own internal class forces, right?
Maybe so, but I think the idea that the belief in a fixed pie of wealth and therefore the need to take it from somebody else if you're going to grow, I think we've convinced ourselves since Elie Heckscher that that's at the core of mercantilist thinking, and I just don't think it is. Yes, zero-sum thinking is absolutely central to mercantilism, but it doesn't come from a belief in a fixed pie of wealth. You can believe, like, say, the English political economist John Kerry, that wealth is infinitely expansible through a process of improvement whereby human labor is applied to nature. And you can still be absolutely paranoid about any development that seems to favor French trade. And the reason for that is because they're equating commerce with power, and power is a positional good. By definition, if you have more power, I have less power. So that's where the zero-sum thinking comes from. It's from thinking of commerce as, in the first place, the foundation of the power of nations, the foundation of power of states in competition with one another. So you can have a fixed pie imaginary or an infinitely expansible imaginary. It doesn't matter if you think that commerce and power are the same thing.
Yeah, I think you get at this in the book when, I forget in which chapter, but you say officials on both sides more and more start to think about the balance of wealth, which I don't know if they're thinking of the concept in the same way as when they write or they say the balance of trade, but whatever the case, it seems to be a more sort of bilateral kind of conception of France versus Britain in terms of their trade. And you say like that kind of highly bilateral sort of focus, it's sort of damaging for at least it's destabilizing as far as commerce goes.
Yeah, it is. It's, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about all of these schemes to cut a deal with the other side is that how few of them actually pan out. One of the things I've had to kind of wrestle with all along is, well, why is that? And it seems like there are ideas that are part of the mix that are very conducive to reducing the level of conflict. But this idea of a bilateral power balance based on commerce seems to have the opposite effect. That it's just, if you think about the world in those ways, it makes you acutely oversensitive to small gains that the other side achieves that you can imagine over time compound to become big differences in the balance. And behind all this, again, the misperception that were one side to really steal a major leap in commercial competition and really pull far ahead of the other, that the consequences would be disastrous. That actually, you know, world history suggests otherwise. You know, and hegemons don't need to be generous, and hegemons never are, I don't think, or benevolent or beneficent. The mere fact of the great commercial supremacy and financial supremacy of one state over its rivals tends to produce bandwagoning rather than coalitions to try and smash the power or strip back the power of the dominant state. And that's a regime that is simply more stable. And a regime, you know, that if you look at France in the 19th century, a regime under which France thrives. It thrives piggybacking on the British Empire. Of course, it helps that Britain changes its policies. And I mean, you can already see this beginning to happen in the 1780s. But for example, in 1713, when it does away with the monopoly of the East India Company on trade with India, it also allows European competitors to trade there on the same basis as Britain's. And Jean-Baptiste Say even writes at that point, and he says, look, we should give up struggling to carve out a piece of empire for ourselves in South Asia. We should trade there under British protection. This is actually going to be advantageous to us. And that's the same grounds that you see in the several efforts in the 1780s to cut a deal between France and Britain and India. This idea that Britain, the British Empire, could be the protector of French trade, leave to the British their sovereignty, their political control, and without bearing any of the costs of sovereignty, enjoy the profits of trade. But that involves thinking about the Franco-British relationship in a fundamentally different way that's very difficult for French policymakers in the 18th century.
Yeah, maybe last question before perhaps we can turn to more general questions. Talking about the post-Seven Years' War period and kind of France's new position, right? Losing the bulk of its overseas possessions, except, I guess, the Sugar Islands. And I think you chart how policymakers, it's multifaceted, but for example, someone like the Duc de Choiseul, right? You write that he sort of conceives of a new sort of decentralized or deterritorialized kind of empire. Whether or not he succeeds in carrying out that project is another story. But I was sort of wondering if you could break down what were these new competing visions of empire on the French side and how they relate to this longstanding rivalry with Britain in the post-Seven Years' War period.
I think we don't appreciate how much ambivalence there is about empire in the 18th century among officials and ministers, leading figures in the imperial powers. They're constantly asking the question, are we getting more gain from this in terms of commerce than we're losing in terms of the cost of administration and defense? Administration cost is not huge, but the defense cost is crushing because something like the Seven Years' War, this is a war that's really over American empire. And so the entire bill for that war, really, you have to put it into the column of the cost of empire. And they're thinking in these terms. And of course, you know, you see the same kind of thinking in Adam Smith. Adam Smith, his fundamental objection to American empire, well, he has two. One is that it diverts investment away from places where it might have been more productive. But the other is that defending American empire is inordinately expensive, and the Americans are not paying anything for it. Anyway, the point is that at the end of the Seven Years' War, there's a lot of thinking in these terms. How can we do empire more cheaply? And how can we do it in a way that doesn't lead inevitably to conflict with the other side, which is just makes the cost of empire unbearable? And this is where you see a lot of discussion of inter-imperial free trade in the 1760s as a way, the British talk about it as a way to sort of absorb the French and Spanish colonies commercially without having to fight for them and without bearing any of the cost of sovereignty. So it's actually a replacement for that much more aggressive Pittian vision of free trade. In the case of the Duc de Choiseul, who's Louis XV's leading minister and really the architect of the French Empire in the post-Seven Years' War period, his vision is of a French Empire that's going to be small and lean, where the colonies are going to be territorially minimal, protected using sort of small military enclaves, where you're going to... Choiseul actually cheerfully gives up Canada as part of the peace negotiations because he thinks, A, it's commercially non-viable, and B, it's constantly dragging us into frontier frictions with the British. And that's what the Seven Years' War came out of. And that's a war we can't afford to fight again. So he has a vision of this sort of smaller, leaner, more commercially viable French empire that's going to cost less to defend. And that comes along with, you know, several other policies. One is he has the idea that the best way to conduct French trade in India would be under the protection of a League of Indian States. So the idea is maybe you need empire to protect trade in India, but you don't need your own empire. You can use somebody else's. Can't be your enemies, can't be Britain's, but it could perhaps be an empire, a kind of revived Mughal empire. But you'd have to cut the East India Company down to size first. So it would require a war. And that's something that, you know, Choiseul is actively planning. And in fact, there's documents the British get a hold of, French war plans in 1768, for example. It doesn't come to that, but there's a plan afoot. You know, I'm realizing in talking about this particular example, that there's a really central theme that we haven't really talked about and that we should, because I think in the end it's sort of central to the whole book. And that's the idea of protection, which we often think of quite narrowly when we're thinking about trade. Protection in the sense of protectionism. Protection is actually something much bigger than that. This is something that the economist Frederick Lane wrote a series of really interesting articles about in the 1940s and 1950s. My vision of protection isn't exactly the same as Lane's. Here's the basic proposition. The proposition is that capitalism requires protection. It requires it at home in the form of a state that is going to backstop capitalist property rights. A state that's going to go to bat for the capitalists in a redistributive crisis, right? When the workers are seeking to redistribute assets or take a larger share of the pie. A state that supplies a stable currency, courts, a legal system, police, etc. Right? Capitalism requires that kind of protection to flourish. It also requires protection overseas. And the protection there takes a somewhat different form. The main thing you need to protect trade and investment from is the predatory action of other states. So as soon as you're in a world of competing protection suppliers, competing states, you have this whole new order of problems that merchants, entrepreneurs, et cetera, have to face. It's particularly acute in colonies because you're not only worried about the predation of competing states, but you're also worried about rebellions of the enslaved men and women who are doing work in these colonies and attacks from the indigenous peoples who are forced off this land for these plantations to be established. So there's an acute problem of protection in 18th century capitalism. And all 18th century economists talk about protection. This is not something we say a great deal about, but if you look at Smith, you look at Hume, look at the physiocrats, protection is a key category, protection understood in these terms. The central insight of the book is that this protection regime of 18th century capitalism has a sort of fundamental flaw, which is that it produces far too much conflict. When states protect their trade and investment abroad competitively, it inevitably produces conflict because one state's protection is another state's predation. You just have conflict locked into the system. And what we see in the 18th century is a very unstable international order, war after war, and the accruing of these enormous public debts, which everyone is worried about both constitutionally and economically. And in the end, it's just it's a protection regime for global trade that's not viable because of the costs it produces in terms of conflict. Let's contrast this to the protection regime that we've had roughly since 1945. We don't talk about protection anymore, except in the narrow sense of protectionism. We don't worry about protection because we have this system where protection continues to be just as important as it's ever been, but protection is now offered by sovereign states, which are universalized. And it's offered on the same basis under multilateral agreements through institutions like the World Trade Organization. And this is effectively a mutual non-aggression pact. It says, I won't do the worst things I can to your trade and investment if you don't do the worst things you can to my trade and investment. There's still room for me to stick it to you and vice versa. I can subsidize my research and development. I can build nicer infrastructure. I can adopt environmental rules that make it difficult for you to export your stuff to my country. That's all okay, right? It's a level of conflict that everyone is happy to live with. But what I don't do is simply say, I'm going to appropriate the assets of your investors, or I'm simply not going to allow your goods in here at all. That's what we've had. And it's a regime that's deliberately constructed that way in 1945 in order to avoid the kind of vicious conflict over investment, resources, raw materials that you have between 1914 and 1945. We seem to be in a place here in 2021 where the commitment to that system is fraying, where often the states that have done best out of this system are starting to think, you know, this is not a good deal for us. I think you see this in Brexit. You see it even more clearly in you know, US trade frictions with China. You see it in maritime disputes breaking out here, there, and everywhere, the South China Sea, Antarctica, you know, Eastern Mediterranean, and we're going to see more of that. This system, which has kept the lid on conflict and which has been also extraordinarily good for capitalism in the sense that because it has brought protection costs down so much, and because capital effectively gets protection supplied now below cost, it's an extraordinarily good arrangement for capitalism. And I wonder how much longer it can continue, given the direction things seem to be moving in the last few years.
As you've just been describing, and then also in the book, you're very clear about that, you know, you're hoping that there are lessons to be learned from this history, and you know that we're in a situation now that has some parallels to it, or where there might be something to be drawn from. But I guess I'm just curious. So it seems like one lesson is to, you know, appreciate what you've got when you have sort of a system that's been remarkably successful, as you were just saying, at preventing these kinds of conflicts. But I'm curious what other lessons you're hoping that people can draw from the history that you're describing in the book.
I mean, I should emphasize that I think we live in an unlovely world, right? I don't want to sound like some, you know, rabid apologist for global capitalism. The post-1945 world is a world of profound geoeconomic conflict, a world of deep exploitation of poor countries by rich countries. There are all kinds of reasons not to like what we have. It's just that when you compare it to the alternatives, it starts to look better. One of the reasons that I found working on this project interesting is because you can see that these 18th century officials who are trying to change the international order in their own age are imagining our world. They don't turn out to be able to create it, but they imagine it, a world of relatively free trade. Now, relatively, right? There's no real free trade. When major free trade agreements are written up in two telephone directory sized books, you know that there's a lot of reciprocity. There's a lot of cutouts. Free trade isn't what you know economics describes it to be. It's something that looks a whole lot more like what these 18th century officials imagined it to be. They imagined a world in which rivalries between states would continue unabated and would continue to be prosecuted in this brutal way, but not using war, but rather using trade and investment and economic tools. And that seems to be very much what we have. And that's not pretty. It's exploitative, It's not crazy to use the term empire to describe aspects of it, but this 18th century story does suggest that under a different regime for protecting capital overseas, that is one that is not multilateral, but that's based on the competitive provision of protection, that we are potentially in line for much more profound conflict over trade, investment, et cetera, than has been the case for the last 75 years. So I think that's one of the fundamental lessons, if that's the right word. Another one is that once you're in that kind of scenario, making agreements to get out of it is really hard. It's really hard to make an agreement. It's really hard to make it stick. I think it was possible after 1945 because you had this overwhelmingly dominant commercial and military power that was basically able to set the ground rules, and it set them in ways that benefited itself principally. But there were also significant benefits for other great trading states, either at the time or of the future. So we should realize that for all the inequities and for all the inefficiencies of what we have, it was hard to get to this point, and it's going to be really difficult to rebuild anything like that if we ever decide to move away from it. Now, of course, we live in a different world in many ways, right? We live in a world of weapons of mass destruction. So the costs of war, prospectively, are an order of magnitude higher. And that, you know, that's got to put the brakes to some degree on out-and-out conflict, but not completely. Consider Russia's annexation of Crimea, right? There are all kinds of little things you can do that don't necessarily involve World War III, but that put you in a potentially much better position to dominate the fiber optic cables of the Black Sea, its energy resources, its shipping lanes, etc. What about Taiwan, a place that has become economically quite central because of its key role in semiconductor production? Would a threat to the independence of Taiwan turn the US's soft protectorate into a hard protectorate? I don't think it's crazy to imagine that. I think in some ways we're already inching towards a different kind of world, and one that's more conflictual. Could you imagine a shooting war over the Spratly Islands between the Philippines, Vietnam, and the People's Republic of China? I don't think it's that hard to envision. And it doesn't necessarily have to, as I say, become World War III. Weapons of mass destruction preclude certain kinds of military struggles, but not all kinds of military struggles. One difference that I think would be material is that in the 18th century, what you have is a multipolar competitive system of protection provision for trade. I don't think that's what we're going to get. I think because we already have a really significant commercial political bloc around the United States and a powerful military alliance or alliances associated with it, much the most likely outcome are two blocs, a China bloc and a US bloc. So I don't think we're going to go back to that kind of, you know, multipolarity that you see in the 18th century. But, you know, the book also suggests that bipolarity is actually very unstable when we think about conflicts of this sort, conflicts over trade, resources, raw materials, investment, etc. Because small gains are imagined to compound over time and to affect the balance of power.
So I have a somewhat naive question in response to that, which is, in the book you write that hegemons are stabilizing, but rising hegemons are destabilizing.
Yeah.
Because hegemons, they'll provide protection costs for everybody else. It's a global public good. It's really great if America just, you know, uses its massive navy to patrol the sea lanes and make sure that, like, you know, French shippers get where they're going. Why would a rising hegemon want to take on the costs of provisioning of the public good of protection if America is going to also make sure that Guangdong shipping lanes get where they're going?
I think we need a realist conception of hegemony here to answer that question. I mean, this is not going to be a struggle over who gets to provide the public goods. I think it's pretty rare for hegemons to supply public goods in that sense. I think a good argument can be made precisely for the role of the US Navy to some degree. I'm not sure that North Korea or Iran would agree exactly on that, but, you know, there's arguably a public good there. Maybe you can attribute the same public good to the British Navy. But I think, for example, the idea that Britain was a benevolent hegemon in the 19th century, for example, has now at this point just been comprehensively exploded. idea that Britain is supplying a public good in the form of free trade for the rest of the world with a deliberate aim of producing a less conflict-prone system, I think that's just proven to be false. There's a much better case to be made for the US taking a deliberate role of that sort after 1945. But why do hegemons do this? They don't do it for idealistic reasons. They do it because they know they're going to benefit more than anybody else. So I think what happens when hegemony is breaking down and when a new hegemon is potentially rising is not a struggle over public goods. It's a struggle over advantage, right? The US concern is that the system of free trade that it's backstopped for the last 75 years has fostered the rise, the very rapid rise of a major geostrategic competitor. And that's true. So the US is going to be tempted, is tempted now, into restricting free trade where China is concerned. And China is going to see that as a threat to its own prosperity and power in the long run, and is going to take some sort of countervailing action. The larger point you started with was the sort of irony that hegemony can be stabilizing, but that the rise of a hegemon is profoundly destabilizing. I think that's a pattern we see over and over again. The Franco-British struggle in the 18th century is a struggle to prevent the other side becoming a hegemon. In the 19th century, British supremacy as a trading power is eroded, particularly by the rise of the United States after 1870, but also by the rise of other great trading states like Germany and Japan. And you know, the consequence in the long run was a shift from a system in which powers were content to bandwagon under British commercial and naval supremacy to a system where powers were committed to going it alone to provide the kind of protection that they came to believe their foreign investment and trade needed, precisely because Britain could not be trusted to provide a public good. It was obvious that Britain was going to rig the system in a way that advantaged its own welfare most and disadvantaged theirs. I mean, I think you can see this in very clear way with Imperial Germany in the 1890s and at the turn of the 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, going off of this might be a little bit too far, but I feel like the classical realist perspective on sort of U.S. foreign policy since fall of the Soviet Union, right, since 1989, is that it's projected its power way too far abroad, whether that's NATO. So someone like George Kennan famously was against NATO expansion after 1989, not even to say the neoconservatives, right, that got us into Iraq II and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I guess this question of like benevolent hegemony, I think you quite rightly state that it's sort of a chimera and that there are always kind of state interests at play. But I was wondering what you make of, I guess my question, and you talked a little bit about this, but the post-1945 US hegemony or empire, I suppose, versus 19th century British. And do you see any differences, similarities? And if, and I guess this is sort of just another comment, but it strikes me that the emerging sort of bipolar situation that you described between US and China is actually more of a parallel with the Franco-British rivalry in 18th century, because more so than this, perhaps the Cold War, the US-Soviet one, because there is this kind of widespread perception, right, in the US that China developed on Americans' dime, basically, right, whereas in the Soviet situation, you know, they were excluded from the Marshall Plan. That's why they had the Common Forms and so forth. But yeah, I was wondering if at all you could comment on some more historical parallels, I guess, between 19th century Britain, the US, US Russia, and perhaps US China today. I know that's a very big.
Let me take a small piece of it. I think that there are striking differences between Britain in the 19th century and the US after 1945. Britain does nothing to deliberately try to construct an international trading order which will be relatively advantageous to all, albeit most advantageous to it. I mean, if you look at the creation of free trade in the 19th century, Britain adopts a unilateral free trading position. This actually puts it in a position where it has nothing to negotiate with in terms of reciprocity, in terms of building broader free trade system. It's France that makes the running in the construction of a free trade system in Europe, first by basically almost forcing Britain into a free trade pact with it in 1860, the Calvin-Chevalier Treaty, and then building a set of other trade treaties with other European countries, all of them using the Most Favored Nation Clause, that ends up constructing this sort of multilateral free trading system. But, you know, Britain is a relatively passive player in all of this. Same with the adoption of the gold standard. I mean, Britain doesn't do anything to, induce other countries or organize a multilateral system in which everyone gets on the gold standard. No, it's actually the pursuit of development goals by catch-up forms of development by other nations that leads to them getting on the gold standard too. It matters enormously that Britain's on the gold standard because London is the center of the global trading system and the center of world finance. So it's advantageous in certain ways to be on the gold standard. But Britain is not doing anything to organize that system. The United States after 1945 is completely different. The United States takes very deliberate steps based on a theory of the sources of international disorder to deliberately build a multilateral trading system and a multilateral payment system. It's at least since the 1930s, the U.S. policymakers, say Cordell Hull, are obsessed with the idea that building of autarkic units, economic units based on economic nationalism, is the fundamental source of international conflict. And World War II just seems to prove the point. And so U.S. policymakers are absolutely committed to the idea that if you're going to have a world that is peaceful and safe for American capitalism after the war, you need to play a very active role in constructing multilateral arrangements. If there's anything we should call hegemony in that sort of more, in that fuller sense of the term, that is a form of dominance that embodies a leadership that other powers, at least some other powers, can see as beneficial to them. It applies to the US after 1945. It doesn't apply, I think, to 19th century Britain. This is not to downplay Britain's importance in the 19th century. It's hugely important, and its commercial and financial dominance is a hugely important fact. But it doesn't use that in the way the US uses it deliberately and constructively as an institution builder. When I contrast the US against U.S. in post-1945 against Britain in the 19th century, it's not to suggest
relative.
That, you know, the U.S. is this idealistic, you know, beneficent. No, I mean, the U.S. is ruthlessly pursuing its own interest, but it understands its own interest to reside in my terms, a multilateral system for the protection of global capitalism. That if you have a system that where protection is supplied competitively, which was the case in the 19th century and which was the case in a particularly, you know, aggressive and competitive way in the 1930s and 1940s, it is a recipe for disaster. It's a recipe particularly for disaster for U.S. capital, which has now, in the course of World War II, accumulated in enormous quantities at home and which needs to be exported overseas, or you're going to have a crisis of overproduction at home. So I don't mean to suggest that the U.S. is this, that we should understand this as benevolence. I think we should understand it as interest. I want to just make a leap here, though, to another point. And another fundamental way in which the U.S. is very different from 19th century Britain, radically different. The U.S. is something like a military hegemon, and Britain never was. Britain always had the smallest. It had a very large and powerful navy, and was certainly navally dominant throughout the 19th century. But its army was, even when you include the Indian Army, it was no match for states even like France in the 19th century, much less Prussia or Russia. The U.S. is very different. The U.S., not immediately in 1945, but after 1953, after the Korean War, has made a wager that it would make sense to keep military spending at a level far, far higher than would normally be the case for a state in peacetime, with the idea that with a huge preponderance of U.S. power, or at least U.S. power in combination with its allies, you create a security environment where it really doesn't make sense to try to challenge the hegemon militarily. And I think that was harder to see during the Cold War, when we imagined there was a military balance, and where to some degree there was because of nuclear weapons. But post-1990s, we clearly live in a world where the distribution of military power is really unusual, where you have the U.S. spending, you know, as much as the next 10 competing states, and 8 of them are its allies.
I think that's totally key to understand, especially the the post-Cold War period. Like, I guess I'm getting this from Chalmers Johnson, but the, you know, US has over 800 military bases around the world or something like that. And the sort of geographic spread of US military presence is one of the reasons why I think, you know, you get these flare-ups in South China Sea or even the Indian Ocean, right? They're, you know, global US military presence buttressed by a lot of military procurements is kind of turning US into an empire. At least that's Johnson's argument.
I think it's both stabilizing and destabilizing, right? It's stabilizing in the sense that the costs of conflict against the US are just so immensely high that, you know, it really gives pause to any actor, especially any great power actor that might consider, you know, going head to head. On the other hand, because of the reconceptualization of US security interests as being global, something which I think is happening during World War II, it just puts the US into dozens, hundreds of potential friction zones where, you know, when something happens, it's easy to argue that the credibility of the US as a military power is on the line, and then you get this absurd overreaction. So there's something this immense military power, immense concentration of military power, has arguably been one of the keys to the non-return to the kind of conflict we see in the first half of the 20th century, a truly existential, you know, apocalyptic conflict. And on the other hand, it's clearly the source of the dozens of small wars and medium-sized wars. And the US has played this destabilizing role all over the world, and at the same time is this profound stabilizer within international politics. And I think you have to see both. But we're at this point, we're far from the 18th century, and I might be on thin ice.
To add more to your point, American military procurements is also key towards elite formation abroad, right? So like, I'm thinking about Taiwan and Korea here, where the elites in those countries really come together around opposition to communism and are funded by America. Same thing with Japan, same thing with Germany, same thing with, I mean, lots of different countries, right? So it's simultaneously geopolitical and geoeconomic, and it like,
yeah,
you build the system completely.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that the is American empire, you know, is hovering on the edge of this conversation. I think that's an interesting question. For me, the question would be, is the protection regime for global capitalism, is it still imperial, right? It was organized on the basis of empires in the 18th and 19th centuries, really through to the 1960s in many ways. Is it still? Have we just exchanged one set of empires for a different kind of empire? Or do we get something that's really fundamentally new in the decades after 1945? That is a system where all the capitalist great powers are effectively allies and collaborating with one another, and have constructed a system where you know some are going to do better than others, but everyone's going to do well, and often at the expense of poorer countries. The question of American empire for me is partly a question of rupture or continuity. Calling it an empire, aside from the politics of the thing, I'm not talking about the political edge that using that language implies, but just in analytic terms, calling it an empire implies nothing's fundamentally changed. And that's really my only objection to it analytically, because I think there are interesting ways in which the post-1945 world really is sui generis in the history of capitalism, and that the language of empire can tend to occlude that.
Yeah, I think I tend to agree with your line, John. Yeah, it's tough because I guess going back to the 18th century, you know, the 18th century Republicans and, you know, the founders of the American Republic, like if you read, you know, George Washington's farewell address, right, he's all about preventing militarism and power politics and keeping US insulated from entangling alliances with the old world, right? Because he sees those as emblematic of the darker sides of, I think, the 18th century international system that you quote really qualifies the picture. But nevertheless, I think someone like Washington wanted to avoid the costs of empire, and not only like the protection costs, right? The costs to domestic politics, sort of corruption, and you can say, you know, the militarization of society or something like that, right? But I think that's another piece that goes not unmentioned, but is sometimes forgotten with what you were saying since the Korean War, you know, the massive military presence of the US around the world and how that inflects back domestically. But at the same time, I totally agree with you. The post-45 order, I think, is sui generis for a lot of the reasons you say. But I think something does shift after 1989. I think that the sort of continued projection of military power abroad without a rival, right? Without Russia, we had to look for, you know, Islamofascism or the axis of evil in the 90s and the mid-aughties, which is kind of absurd. And now, of course, we have China replacing that. But
yeah. But it makes you realize that the point all along wasn't simply to contain communism. There was another point. The point was to contain conflict among capitalist states. And that's why the US doubles down. Well, look, I'm not suggesting that policymakers sit around in a smoke-filled room and kind of plot this thing out. I think it's kind of more structural than that. But you can see when you take the Soviet Union out of the picture that the Cold War facilitated the creation of a system of protection provision that's been enormously valuable for capitalism, because great capitalist trading states, instead of fighting it out among one another, have cut deals, partitioned resources, opened markets, and generally avoided the kind of conflict between those kinds of states that had been endemic since the rise of the Dutch Republic in the 17th century.
So having done away with hegemony as a master concept for narrating modernity, we've now also done away with with empire and the threat from below the proletariat. So I guess we're just stuck with, you know, thinking what we're doing in our own times for ourselves.
Yeah. Maybe to end, because I think, Nick, you maybe you wanted to go back to Ishvan Pant and this question, because I feel like he's a really interesting figure.
Oh, I love Ishvan Pant. I can talk about him for hours.
Because I feel like he's continuity and rupture, right, between 18th century and today. I feel like he reads a lot of the canonical writers in the sort of tradition of political economy that he's concerned with in a very modern, like, IR realist sort of George Kennan way, right? They're thinking strategically about, I guess maybe the exception is possibly Smith. I think he explores Smith's system in a more sort of normative kind of way. But a lot of the other people he talks about, they're purely concerned with kind of security dilemmas and access to resources and protection costs and so forth. But yeah, so John, I just wanted to pose to you. Earlier, you mentioned that you were both influenced by someone like Kant, but also you depart from him in several ways in your interpretation. I was wondering if you might want to elaborate on what you meant there.
Sure. My conception of political economy as as an advice discourse for the managers of competing commercial states. I mean, I think Hunt doesn't use that language exactly, but he says something like that. And I think it's easy to forget, 30 years on, what a sort of revolutionary rereading of political economy that was, when he and his, his collaborators introduced it. So I'm in the same neck of the woods as Ishvan Hunt, and in many ways looking at the same 18th century and looking at many of the same sources. I'm also similar to Ishvan Hunt and inspired by Ishvan Hunt in that he sees a peace project as being central to 18th century political economy. But I think we see it in different places. I think he sees the apogee of that peace project in the political economy of someone like David Hume and in the physiocrats, maybe in the physiocrats above all. And it's not that I would deny that that physiocracy or Hume's political economy are peace projects. They absolutely are. It's just, I don't think they're the really influential ones. To use Hunt's own language, I think that the dominant peace project or peace projects in the 18th century are neo-Machiavellian. They're mercantilist. They're not based on some notion of du commerce or the idea that there's any kind of automatic or mutually beneficial relationship between trading states if you can just have free trade. These guys don't think that at all. They think that, well, I won't go on about it. Let's call them neo-Machiavellian peaceniks, right? And of course, they're never for peace as such. It's always strategic. It's like this at this particular moment, peace would be advantageous to us, and for this reason and that reason. So that's one important difference with Hunt. But the other one is, as we already discussed, the place where I see the center of gravity of 18th century political economy, which is in the ministries, the chancelleries, the embassies, the boardroom of the East India Company and its French and Dutch rivals. I think that is more central for understanding the story of political economy in the 18th century. And I think that we need to situate the better known story of enlightened political economy, the emergence of a kind of more or less liberal reading of political economy vis-a-vis that story. And of course, that's partly inspired by Hunt, but it's also peeling away from him in looking at very different kinds of sources and in being fundamentally focused on the problem of reception rather than only on the problem of the emergence of new ideas in the course of conversations between men of letters.
Maybe that's a good place to leave off. Thank you so much for coming on, John. This has been super informative and really interesting.
Sure. My pleasure. I'm now exhausted. When you said 2 hours, I didn't really believe you.
I don't me either.
Reviving Growth Keynesianism is produced by me, Nick Johnson. The podcast is supported financially by the University of Chicago Program for Professional Advancement and Training for Humanists and Humanistic Social Scientists. If you enjoyed this discussion, please follow us wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and consider leaving us a positive review, which will help us connect with more engaged listeners like you. More information on our ideas can be found at revivinggrowthkeynesianism.org. There you can also find our Patreon. We would greatly appreciate if you chose to support us. All donations allow us to put out more content for thoughtful listeners like you. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.